"Who is that?" Des asked. Ilgar glanced up at the glowing green elephant.
"You are feasting your eyes upon the last remaining member of the Inaki species. Wormhole 66Y71. We call her Big Bubs. Took out their homeworld, since it was in the neighborhood anyway. Started the whole damned war. Alabil over there was just a little kid. He skipped school and ran off joyriding around the outer planets with his Sieve friends. May the first general unkillable fact bless and keep his big dumb heart. He turned up with all his homework done anyway, because Alabil is just about the sweetest idiot who ever lived. And well, the rest is the utter and fiery annihilation of total war. That's why it wouldn't be fair to let him do the semi-finals, on account of there's only one of him. So, what'll it be, mister?"
Decibel tore his eyes away. He had understood virtually none of what the bartender said. He contemplated the various shelves of escapism fuel, reached down into the storehouse of his soul, and found that he did not, after all, have any obligation to accept his limitations. He could push through, change his mouthguard, rinse his mouth out, and plow back in. The comeback kid.
"How about a Cosmo?" he said sunnily. "I don't even like them. I just want to see you make one, gorgeous."
The drooling space horror blinked several times, turned round to face the diverse bottles of booze on the back wall, picked up a dainty cocktail glass in his thick fingers, glared at it in fury, then turned back around and blinked a bit more.
"So, yeah, how do I, you know, Cosmo?"
Decibel leaned conspiratorially across the bar. "Honestly, I don't really know either. I think you're sort of interfere with a cranberry. Too complicated. Let's go for something classic, strong, manly, easy. Whiskey, neat."
"Excellent choice."
Ilgar Bloodtub turned around again with the cocktail glass still in his hand. He stood there for several minutes.
"And how do I make one of them?"
"You take a glass and put a lot of whiskey in it."
"Right, I get that. But how do I make the whiskey part? And the neat bit? I don't really neat, if you know what I mean. I'm better at mutilate or impale."
"Fine, fine. Doesn't matter. Pint of lager. Nothing simpler." The Yurtmak devourer of spleens sighed. His vestigial ears oozed pheromonal wax. He turned around, bound and determined not to let go of that cocktail glass, the one thing he felt reasonably good about. He held it up next to a bottle labeled Cherry Schnapps. Then he started to cry.
"Oh, come on, I can see the taps right there,"
Decibel snapped in frustration.
"Don't shout at me."
"I thought this was supposed to be the South Wharf Hilton, all done up special for us, mint condition. I have personally gotten completely, totally, paleolithically drunk at this very establishment, and I distinctly recall that the first step to success in that regard was pulling a measly pint of lousy beer."
"You're supposed to be nice to me,"
Ilgar Bloodtub sobbed in abject embarrassment. Bloody tears dripped down over his muzzle.
"You're supposed to be on best behavior because we're all judging you, And if you think I don't get a vote tomorrow, you're very seriously mistaken, you muppet. You can't talk to me like that. You're descended from bonobos. I'm descended from Goganar Gore Cannon on my mum's side, and I'm not even making that up. I don't need to impress a bonobo. I kill nicer boys than you for fun.
Decibel Jones deftly sensed that he was losing control of the situation. All right. You're right. We're just having a chat about mixology, aren't we? Come on, darling. We can do this. We can get through this together. Life is challenge. Just grab a glass and hold it under the tap and pull. Believe and achieve. I saw you make something way fancier than a pint for that Alunazar back there.
No, you don't understand. That was a long, slow wormhole up against the wall with a twist. I know how to make that. Everyone loves those. I've got all the ingredients right here. Oh, do you want that? Only, I don't know if you have the blood chemistry for it. How many proteins encode your DNA? Under 6, and I'm supposed to get you to sign a waiver.
I'll give it a miss.
These aren't taps, see?
Yilgar waggled a big wooden Boddington's tap. Nothing came out, but a trapdoor opened over by a guild of Lumitus. They peered over at it, then awarded themselves 5 points each.
They don't connect to kegs. It's all for show. We rather thought you'd never ask. You're supposed to be professionals. You know alcohol is bad for your throat. Rex, your mid-range tone. We just tipped a lot of our hooch into your bottles and called it a job well done. It's like Great Aunt Goganar's 6th unkillable fact. Everything just gets so fucked up sometimes, and the natural resting state of reality is not to make any goddamn sense if it can help it, and you've just got to accept that because it's not going to get any better from here on in.
Decibel Jones felt as though he might just have to have a scream if he had to listen to one more life lesson from something that looked like a zoo tossed into a blender. He made mournful eyes at the fake taps. Isn't there anything I can drink back there? Yilgar Bloodtub squatted down and rummaged under the bar. Jones heard a lot of scraping, knocking, and at least one distinct cry for help, before the Yurtmak re-emerged with a mug of hot tea, a pot of honey, and a fat lemon wedge. He gave Des a meaningful, motherly look.
Careful, it's hot. Now, look, I'm sorry about my little cry. It's only because I wanted to bite your face in half, and I've already been written up twice for maiming the punters, so I just didn't have any other emotional outlet available to me. So, the score is this. Even though you yelled at me at my place of business, we, Yurtmak, remember what it was like when we were new and living with the possibility of everything we'd ever built being summarily vaporized on account of a bum note. We're all pulling for you. Team Human.
Christ, really? I didn't think anyone was. Except maybe Clippy and the Roadrunner. I don't really know what's going on between E and Ought, except double vowels, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't extend to the masses.
That's such a relief to hear. You have no idea. It's a tough room out there.
Nasuno Oof, the brutally elegant smaragdy performance artist who had so recently and efficiently condemned the better part of human history, sidled up and leaned a pronged elbow against the bar. The low lights glowed against her glossy armored plates.
"Hey, sailor,"
she said silkily in the direction of Decibel Jones. "This contemptible vermin has been looking for you. Buy a worthless conversational dumpster fire a drink?"
"Fuzzy Rutu?"
Ylgar offered. The Smaragdin didn't much seem to care either way. Her eyes were the most extraordinary violet slits.
"Listen, about all that lion business back there," she began. "We all have traumatic puberties."
"Don't apologize. You were very fair."
Des sipped his tea.
"The defense will stipulate that we're rubbish. Genocidal meatbags with mummy issues and embarrassingly poor impulse control. As far as quality housemates to be found on planet Earth, it goes. Dolphins, elephants, orangutans, occupy, then every single spider, then Joan of Arc, the Dalai Lama, Mr. Rogers, Freddie Mercury, my nan, all the scorpions, German measles, a dented recycling bin, and then maybe some of the rest of us. It's grim."
Nasuno's remarkable eyes went all wide and warm and soft. She put one severe, three-fingered hand on his elbow.
"Mr. Jones, are you trying to seduce me?"
"I'll tell you what, darling. If low self-esteem and public humiliation is your bag, Earth may not be such a raw deal for you."
"How fascinating that you should say so. Perhaps this untitled monochrome canvas in the Museum of Politico-Cultural Relevance might have reason to travel there one day soon."
"I don't know what's in this tea. Ylgar, you charmer."
He peered into the mug.
"Honesty, I suppose. Look, Nessie, my love, the way it's headed, in about 24 hours, the only reason to visit Earth will be if you're really, really into squirrels."
"Perhaps very soon?"
"I'll alert the squirrels."
The ivory smaragdin glanced over at Ylgar Bloodtub.
"Mr. Jones, do try to focus. This morally depraved dishrag is, perhaps unsurprisingly, given that her soul is a continually oozing oil spill, for sale."
"Me too,"
chirped the Yurtmak bartender.
"Though my soul is more of a pinata full of knives."
Decibel blinked.
"What do you mean?"
Nasuno Oof spread her beautiful claws.
"The Smaragdi are members of the Octave. We have significant voting power in the Grand Prix. The Yurtmak are not, but they have a great deal of influence with the smaller species, since they tend to start hitting one another with shovels when they can't agree on what constitutes good art."
"I don't know why that bothers everyone so much."
Ylgar wiped ichor off his chin with a bar napkin.
"We'd never shovel you. We keep it Yurtmak. How else are you supposed to deal with people who like terrible things? Hit them with a shovel till they stop. That's how. That should be the 30th unkillable fact, I tell you what."
"Be that as it may," continued Oof,
"the two of us alone is just enough to shift the tally should you do really poorly tomorrow. We're more than willing to do that for you, in exchange for a small fee." Decibel narrowed his eyes.
He'd worked with recording studios. He knew when he was about to get body slammed by the fine print.
"How
small. Nasuno Oof lowered her voice to an impossibly seductive murmur. Infinitesimal, she said. Let us say, India. Decibel Jones took a long, long sip of tea, as several Ursulas and a Slosset began rounding up Lumo stones and chucking them in the fountain outside to try to short them out. He drank his tea and thought about lions. He thought about rhinoceros horns. He thought about that photo of the nasty little chap sitting pretty on a mountain of dead buffalo. He thought about the Lakota. He thought about Tasmania. He thought about the Belgian Congo and the West Bank. He thought about Nani and cool Uncle Takumi and Papa Jalishka, and some part of him just gave up and liquefied. But not all. Not quite all. I appreciate your interest in my work, he said in the voice he always used to turn down endless well-meaning yet humiliating Where Are They Now programs. But I must decline due to other commitments. Yilgar thumped the bar with one fist. Dirt scattered.
Listen, Bonobo. The 3-2-1 are really good this year. Their algorithms are totally unbeatable as far as the bookies are concerned. And then there's the Meleg. That's the little bear fellows in the corner by the cold cuts. They literally serve their own hearts sashimi to the crowd, and via the digestive process, the song of their beings actually becomes a part of you. You can't compete with that.
Nope. Then what's a little India between friends? Coaxed the Smaragdin Chantus. Decibel Jones achieved full, mystical, holistic oneness with his tea. Pro tip, he said, smacking his lips. Next time you want to play colonial space monopoly with a British subject whose very favourite grandmother was Pakistani, you may not want to bring up India. Especially after reminding me what a demonic cabbage humanity can be when it wants something bad enough. When it wants to snatch spoils it didn't earn. Allow me to be one of the few historically significant Britons to say, India is none of my business. Thanks for the tea, blood tub. See you on the morrow, as it were, upon St. Crispin's Day.
You must be very confident of your song, Nasuno said with a frown.
Oh, I'm not. Not at all.
And I don't mean that like you mean you're worthless and horrible and a dish rag.
You weren't listening earlier.
I don't have a song.
We don't have a song. Nothing good, anyhow. It's a mess and there's no bridge and no hook and no time and no hope. You should have seen us on that ship, bickering like children, digging up the dead so we could beat each other down with her bones. And now what? Nothing and no time. Good work, everyone. Bravo. Everything's fucked.
You're amazing, Nasuno breathed out.
Such technique.
You'd be a sensation on Palul.
Tell me more. Give me your best set.
What's the worst thing that's ever happened to you?
Decibel Jones went pale. His throat tightened, and his stomach instantly rejected what was almost certainly not tea.
Mira. Nani. Ultrapunks.
The last gasp of the Yuzosh Frockade blossomed on his chest. A dark, red corsage, a gaping gunshot wound, bleeding sequins where his heart should be. Where they weren't. Where nothing had been right since.
There, said Nasuno Oof.
Now you're perfect.
My place or yours? 28. Mr. Music Man. Ought St. Ultraviolet bolted out of the early 21st century South Wharf Hilton onto a rather needlessly picturesque veranda for a breath of air, blood streaming from the back of his neck where a Sloshit's stinger had grazed him as he'd tried to pick out a few seeds, with no guidance whatsoever from bins marked with ridiculous labels like Love Wasted and Till We Meet Again and The Folly of Youth and The Bad Old Days and Peace at the End of All Things. He'd kicked it so hard the lavender beastie had crashed through the dessert bar. Clippy assured him the Sloshit possessed no natural venom. Ort's heart tried to make a run for it out of his chest. Christ, he could really die here. Not at home, in an instant of cleansing fire, along with everything else he'd ever known. But here, right now, with a giant moth's giggling dumb face goggling at him and making victory fists in the air. Pink ferns and marble statues of famous historical rose bushes lined the creamsicle-coloured Italianate balcony. A cut glass fountain gurgled pleasantly, spraying everything with citrus-scented mist. And the perpetual twilight breeze of Litost reeked of bubblegum, fresh grass, and the joyful unity of all living things. The view was just showing off, really. Hundreds of feet below, a lavender sea crashed against pearlescent rocks, and every time the waves boomed, it sounded like children laughing. "It's just unnecessary," Ort said as he cupped his hands in the fountain and splashed water on his face. "That's what it is." He coughed harshly, then stuck his hand in again and slurped up several handfuls. The fountain was geysering top-shelf gin and tonic out of a vaguely neoclassical crystal cornucopia, because, of course it was. The booze flowed up through a curling tunnel full of stained glass roses, marching gracefully in one end and out the other. Though it was undoubtedly a fine sculptural piece, the whole thing felt unsettlingly intestinal. Ought St. Ultraviolet, lately of suburban Cardiff, had no reason on heaven or earth to recognize a wormhole. He wiped his hands on his English bloke man suit and peeked over the vertigo-enticing edge. No Hilton had ever stood this tall. And even if one had, they'd have put bars on the balcony to keep people from lobbing themselves off. He doubted anyone had ever committed suicide here on planet Prozac. And the idea suddenly revolted him. He hated this place. What was the point of a world without debilitating bitterness and despair? How could you even tell you were alive? How could you possibly write a decent pop song if you weren't a sad sack of tissues, or at least fundamentally angry at the world most of the time? Everything could be divided into anger chords, sad chords, and happy chords. And anyone worth their liner notes knew you only reached for more than one or two happy chords in a genuine fiscal emergency. Ort wished he'd brought cigarettes, and that he hadn't stopped smoking 10 years ago. A small person leaned forward over the railing beside him. It looked like a basketball glued on top of a traffic cone, with a couple of bare birch branches stuck into the sides, like some kind of depressed snowman. All spray-painted blacker than midnight on the winter solstice at the bottom of the sea. On the pastel veranda, drenched in soft, summery dusk, it looked completely out of place. Like someone had cut out a piece of black construction paper and glued it to an impressionist painting. Its matte, charcoal skin seemed to just slurp the light. The childlike thing looked up at him with gorgeous, massive, fishy eyes that had long ago told its nose to clear off and make room.
"Don't stay out here too long,"
the Elec said in the voice of a laddish scenester who'd once rolled up an entire star system and smoked it.
"You'll catch happy."
"I doubt it."
"The atmosphere of this planet is 11% serotonin, 4% melatonin, and 1% aerialized cocaine. Might as well enjoy it.
The onyx creature clawed somewhere around its presumptive ribcage with those skeletal fingers and came up with two black cigarettes as long and skinny as emo jeans. The brand was printed around its filter in silver. The menthol bin. Ort took it with a rush of ozone-boosted gratitude more powerful than any orgasm he'd ever had. He laughed shakily. God, this planet was the worst. He awkwardly pantomimed, checking his coat for a lighter, knowing full well he wouldn't find one. The alien blinked slowly. The tip of Ort's ciggy glowed hot green. They resumed looking out at the sea.
Haven't felt a thing, Ort said gruffly, his knees still trembling. Air conditioning. You'll never beat the Claveret for HVAC installation and repair. Otherwise, who would get any work done?
No name tag?
Nah, fuck that. If they don't know me by now, I can't be asked. Social performance is not my scene. Besides, I respire through my skin. See?
The dark little cone man stuck his cigarette against his chest. Sooty smoke rings puffed out through his forehead.
I can't be having with any adhesives. I'll choke. And they know it, too. They're just selfish. But the young always are. Well, my name is Dark Boy Zaraz.
Ort started to introduce himself, but Zaraz waved his stick hand in the air.
Nah, it's all black. I know who you are. I'm a fan.
Space Crumpet?
What?
Ultrapods.
Who now?
Must be my seminal work for the West Cornwall Pasty Company that rocks your boat, then.
No, I don't care about that. It's all rubbish. You want to know my groove?
Definitely.
1998. Didsbury Church of England Primary School. Manchester, England. You were in the choir. Had a solo in the Christmas concert. You sang, It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, while some third year backed you up on alto xylophone. Wasn't the song. Wasn't the production values. Damn sure wasn't the xylo. That poor kid couldn't find the note with a metal detector and two maps. It was the fear. You opened that primitive Sunboy 8 mouth, and out came this true black midnight river of fear and need and disdain. 'Cause you hated that song. Be honest, you'd have drowned it in the nearest toilet if you could. But all that was mixed down with this thumping, oomps, oomps, 1 million BPM oversampling of wanting to be good, wanting to be everything. Because no way was my pitch-perfect baby gonna let some twee trash carol get in between him and the love of the crowd. Look, I'm only Elec. Fully mastered multi-track emotional slag heaps are what I am all about. Weirdest club track I ever heard, but that jam was well dark, son. Pure obsidian.
Dark Boy Zaraz snapped his twiggy fingers in appreciation. Ort blinked. How could you possibly have heard that?
They broadcast the whole thing on Radio 4. Some charity drive. The cashette picked it up when they were doing reconnaissance. He knows I collect rare bootlegs. He hooked me up right inky. I played it on repeat for a week. The girls thought I was mad, threatened to bin me themselves if I didn't stop.
The girls?
My band.
Zaraz was starting to get a little manic with all the fresh air.
You know, we're all bands here. Not gonna claim we're the best of the best, but we've been together 40 years now. Call ourselves Once You Go Black. We're your run-of-the-mill grimecore spectro tango billy combo. We play all the oldies. The dark at the end of the tunnel. When you wish upon a falling experimental FTL engine core,
Leave it black.
Oh, come on. You must know leave it black. I see a black door and I'm extremely satisfied with how it looks. I know you're from a primitive planet, but I feel bad for you, 00 Ultraviolet. I'll make you a mixtape. Anyway, we've been around since the invention of agriculture. You know DJ Lights Out? No? She used to be our stop-stop dancer, before she went solo. The bitch. We mostly play weddings, funerals, pubs, cruise ships, that sort of thing. Summers we hit resorts up and down the binary belt. I do big dance numbers, any rapping or Gregorian chanting that needs doing, and rock the dark matter didge. My flow is jet. Ask anybody. Sagrada sends us to the Grand Prix just about every year, even though we never win, because we're the interstellar equivalent of a bunch of adorable grandparents in clogs or lederhosen or boat hats. But I'm telling you, we do it so damn sable, they don't want anyone else. Somebody's got to get up there in traditional costume and sing the songs of their people and remind these beat junkies what's coal.
Ort could feel the translator fungus on his throat steaming with the effort of interpreting whatever the Elec had actually said that came out as clogs, lederhosen, and boat hats. They were quiet for a while. Ultraviolet tried to blow smoke rings and failed endearingly. He never could get that right. His mother could do it, no problem. She'd always start grinning like a little girl for no reason, so you knew she was going to do her trick. Then she'd open her mouth, and out would come two neat, perfect O's. Decibel had always assumed that Ort had named himself after the cloud, and he supposed he had, just not the one out beyond Pluto. "I don't know how you heard all that junk in my Christmas carol," Ort said, finally. Dark Boy Zaraz made a sound like feedback, the rare Elec laugh.
"Sorry, kid. On the big evolutionary board, human ears score somewhere between a retired roadie and a garden gnome. Even your dogs hear better than you. It's bloody shameful. Sorry, I'm working on being more culturally sensitive. It's a struggle when your culture is so much better and older and more advanced than anyone else's. I take an extension course. We have mantras and stuff, always trying to better myself. So let's try again. It's not your fault the average Pomeranian has better ears than Mozart on a good day."
Zaraz rolled his eyes and recited his mantras.
"I am not morally superior, more deserving of love and wealth, or more fun at parties, just because they're both deaf compared to me. You can choose your friends, you can choose your outfit, but you can't choose the environmental conditions that led to the evolution of your specialized anatomy."
The Elec shrugged.
"Can't see for shit on my planet. Anyone who can't hear the childhood trauma of a Tasaklian porcutiger at 1,000 yards is instant amuse-bouche."
Ort couldn't help feeling a bit bruised in the pride. "I have excellent hearing. I test off the charts. Always have."
"Oh,"
Zaraz said, and patted Ort's velvet-padded elbow.
"Precious."
Ort wanted to stand up for his side and proclaim the auditory virtues of his species, but the wind was just too soft and sweet and mixed with white-collar drugs. "I was scared, though. You were right. I begged the choir master to just let me play the piano like always, but my parents thought it would be good for my anxiety. I stood up there all by myself, and everything smelled like poinsettias and middle-class values, and everybody's different brands of dryer sheets. And I hated it. I never wanted to sing alone again, so I didn't. Worked out all right for a while. I've never been scared since, except now. The song's not done, Zaraz. Not even close. I can feel how good it might be in my chest, but... well, you know, Des and me, without Mira, we're just Des and me, not the Zeros, just one and two. Dark Boy Zaraz stubbed out his cigarette on a marble statue of some war hero rosebush.
Listen, 00, I like you. You're in the black with me. Been that way since I first heard little baby you singing about angels bending near earth and jamming on golden harps to bring on the end of the history and the beginning of a new era. Where I come from, we call that foreshadowing, my man. You're the real char, I can tell. And I'm feeling right suave at the moment with all this psychedelic breathing I'm doing. I'm going to make you a midnight offer. One I've never made to anybody before, and I've seen a lot of weird, shitty, fabulous species come across the Grand Prix stage.
Ort's bloodstream was practically carbonated with the narcotic sea breeze by then. His scalp felt like it had been rubbed all over with velvet valentines, and the kind of perfume that came in bottles with squeeze bulbs. Oh? What's that? The Elec lifted his enormous eyes to meet Ort's. His lashes were so long, they were like burlesque curtains. It was ridiculous. How could he see with those things on? Ort started to giggle, but he stopped when Dark Boy Zaraz laid it all out.
Let me save you.
God. Really?
That would be amazing. Shit. I'm so relieved, I can't even tell you. This has all just been too much. You won't regret it. You'll see, humanity is all right, really. We've had a few rough spots, but we usually sort of lean in the right direction. Oh, no, sorry, bad form on my part. I didn't mean humanity. No chance. I collect rare bootlegs, remember? I've heard all your people's greatest hits. You're not even borderline sentient in my book. I don't even know why they're letting you go on tomorrow.
Ah, you mean Nuremberg, Hiroshima, Soviet State Radio, Kosovo, Rwanda, Calais, the markets crashing in 29 and 87 and 08 and 24, that sort of thing?
I don't know what that stuff is. I mean 5 minutes tuned into a Christian AM radio and or any given top 40 station tells me your species is about as sentient as a great white shark with the rickets. The carpenters alone pretty much disqualify you. No, I mean, let me save you. Not humanity, not the choir master at Didsbury Church of England Primary School, not Decibel Jones. You. Or Saint Ultraviolet, Omar Jalishkan. Let me come through cloven skies with peaceful wings unfurled and get you the hell out of here. We can swing by your place and pick up your offspring and mate if that's what you're worried about. My homeworld is where everyone and their furtive uncle puts things to forget about forever. No one will ever know I swiped you off the dock. You can live a nice life on Sagrada. You'll want for nothing. We'll set you up in a house down the murky shore. Maybe you can curate the Homo sapiens sapiens exhibit in the Melanoa Trementis Library. Maybe. No pressure at all. Life on Shadow Street, baby. And hey, you never know. Maybe your boy Des will pull it out in the end, and all will be right as ravens. But if not, you'll be safe and alive, and so will everyone you love.
Ort was stunned, silent. It had never occurred to him that a way out of this even existed. Now it was holding the escape hatch open for him and yelling for him to go, go, go. The giddy winds of Litost were burning out his higher order functions, stripping his wiring down to bare Paleolithic caveman copper. Decibel would be fine. He always was. Nico and Susie and Justine would be safe. Did anyone else really matter? It was wrong, of course. Absolutely wrong. Monstrously wrong. But who would be around to know? Just then, in the unconditional light of three rosy, shimmering, non-judgmental moons, all he wanted to do was live. Ort St. Ultraviolet dragged the last particles of smoke out of his Elec cigarette. "I hate this planet," he said, looking out to sea toward the red glow of our mums just below the twilight horizon. "I hated it the minute we landed. The way you can catch happy here, like you said. The antidepressant grass and the diamond rain and the peaceful, happy rose bushes being peaceful and happy together, literally breathing in emotional stability with every yawn. But I didn't really know why it pissed me off so much. Sometimes you meet someone and they just rub you the wrong way. No reason it can't go that way with a planet. But that wasn't it. Do you want to know why I hate Letost?"
"Always want to know your thoughts, 00."
Ort St. Ultraviolet, man of 1,000 instruments, flicked his smoke off the balcony, half a mile straight down into the ocean. "Because," he sighed, "if Mira had been born here and not in fucking Sheffield, she'd never have had the eeyores so bad that she tried to nail her tail back on with a speeding van, and I'd still get to take her for gelato at 5 in the morning. He smiled, ruefully, and it turned his face 20 years younger. "No sale, Zaraz. Everybody's got a Nico and Susie and a Justine. AM radio is not even a thing compared to the guy who leaves them all to burn because he doesn't want to get up there with the poinsettias and the xylophone and sing about the angels. It's all of us or none of us." He straightened his suit jacket. English bloke man did not shirk. He did not turn in lackluster work. No matter how the tourists pulled at his hat, he did not move one solitary muscle. "Besides, it'll be good for my anxiety."
"Then let me take out one of the other acts for you,"
came a small, sweet voice. E dashed out of the party floor and scrambled up the side of a rose statue. He looked at Ort with soft eyes.
"I could bludgeon that Vorpret cow and stash it in a broom closet for the duration, and I'd still shut down the after-party before I even felt bad about it. You seem to really loathe the 3-2-1. I can DDoS that paperclip into oblivion without even getting my pulse up. It's no problem at all, Ort."
The time-traveling red panda put his black paw on Ort's cheek.
"I don't want you to die. I'm willing to let 7 billion rubbish humans live if that's what it takes."
"You're not doing your superpower stutter," Ort said, uncertainly. "That's your whole thing. That's your idiom."
"This is a one-timeline deal. It's a moment of weakness on my part. None of the other versions of me want in. No one will ever think less of you. Rule 20, love. It's beyond legit."
"Do you have to kill them?" Ort asked, softly. Dark Boy Zaraz and E exchanged glances. The ancient Elec took one on the moral center.
"Usually we try to avoid non-refundable fatalities, but if you want to be 100% sure, beyond all probability of unforeseen cock-ups, it's safer that way. You don't want to see a Yurtnak lounge singer after she's busted out of a meat freezer."
Ort squeezed his eyes shut and shoved his knuckles into them. He couldn't think. It was like breathing the electric Kool-Aid acid test out here. He'd agree to anything in another minute.
"Ask me in the morning," he whispered, desperately.
"I need to know now, sweetness,"
whispered the Keshet.
"A couple of dumb B-list celebrities you don't even like for the whole of humanity. It's not such a tough call, is it? That's some good math."
E bristled his striped tail and laid his chin on Ort's shoulder.
"Even the nicest song has to have a screamy bit, oh my chick."
Ort gripped the creamsicle railing of that absurd, unnecessary balcony. He blinked back tears.
"E, I can't."
"How is that right? The first thing a human being does when confronted with the universe at large would be to stone-cold murder somebody because he got nervous that maybe their music had a little more mass appeal. And if you're right about us, if we're way more Mark David Chapman than John Lennon, then it'll be about 30 seconds before we start blowing you up just to see the light show,
So what difference would it make in the end? If the whole point of this is what we are, whether we are ready, whether we are fundamentally more than beasts, that seems like the opposite of sentience to me. I can't make that decision for everyone, for the whole of us. From Nefertiti and Homer and Aquinas and Beau Brummel and Marie Curie, all the way down to Nico and Susie and me. I'm not cut out to be the last man on earth. I'm just an ordinary guy. I can't. I'm not fucking Cain. I'm not the first bloke to kill an alien. Not even Clippy. And Clippy is a cunt. A thin spiral shadow fell on the human, the red panda, and the black traffic cone. It spoke in a pleasant, gender-neutral, corporate-approved voice. "This concludes the semi-final round," said Clippy. "You have been cleared to move on to the finals. Would you like to save the changes you've made to this document?" 29. My heart has no color. Capo spent the better part of the evening chasing Yuz particles, which were much more interesting than moths or flies or mice. They kept forming into elaborate word clouds, but as the Esker hadn't bothered to teach her to read when she was flipping switches in her feline brain, she didn't really care what they were trying to say. It was probably, "No, no, bad kitty, don't bite." It usually was, in Capo's experience. She wandered out onto the hotel veranda long after Ort had gone, long after most everyone had gone. They had forgotten about her, but that was all right. She forgot about them plenty. They'd left heaps of food lying everywhere. Creatures who were not cats were terribly slovenly. Capo tried to drink out of the fountain, but it was viciously bitter. She shunned it for offending her and hopped up onto the railing, which would have given anyone else vertigo. But she was not anyone else. She was a cat, and height had no meaning to her. The air didn't get up her nose much either. 1% aerialized cocaine is a bowl of low-fat milk compared to what goes on beyond the feline blood-brain barrier. In fact, she found the high-octane breezes made her sluggish and irritable.
"Let me guess,"
said a breathy, sweet voice behind Capo. She didn't turn to look. She licked her paw. If the owner of the voice wanted to be seen, it would come round. Why waste the energy?
"Backup singer?"
A large, expertly groomed topiary, studded with healthy, pale orange roses, leaned into view. Capo licked her other paw in smug satisfaction.
"No," she said. "They're mine. Only they don't know it." "I see. My name is Elakai. I am one of the claveret singers this year."
Capo yawned. Her eyes bulged. The moon shone on her fangs.
"We're called Hug Addiction,"
the Clavar said, twisting her leaves nervously.
"We have a lot of vibrocellos and a fancy clown."
Capo whipped her white tail back and forth and regarded the rosebush hungrily.
"It's very rare to win 2 years in a row, of course, but that's no excuse not to try your best."
A seabird called somewhere in the distance.
"Anyway, do you plan to perform with him tomorrow, or what?"
Capo's ears twitched. "What do you want?" she purred.
"Well, it's only that you live on Earth as well, you see, and since you're here, your species deserves some consideration. We do try to limit collateral damage in the event of a loss, but accidents will happen."
The cat's tail curled and uncurled lazily. "But I'll be fine," she said, "because I'm here."
"Well, yes, but..."
"Then what's the problem?"
"Miss Capo, you really have to learn to relax. I'm your friend, your happy flower friend. I'm here to make you an offer. The Claveret have a lot of voting power this year as hosts. We could probably sway others to your cause in exchange For a small fee, of course.
Excellent. Do it.
What?
You don't know what the fee is.
Eh.
I was going to say India?
Its climate is very advantageous to botanical life.
Sold. It's over there. Go get it. I will nap here. The claveret maid quivered her petals in distress.
Alternatively, I could perhaps take care of some of your competition for you, as a gesture of alliance. I know that's a bit gruesome.
Capo's bottle-green eyes lit up.
Even better.
Can I help? Who are we killing? Can it be the glittery things? They look tasty.
The Yuz are members of the Octave.
Don't care. Tasty. Ekali turned all her blossoms toward the average British suburban house cat.
Allow me to lay my thorns on the table, as it were. You understand that this is the end of the semi-final round, don't you? I offer these temptations as a test of sentience. It all goes into the evaluation, whether you would sell out your homeworld or murder one of your new neighbors, or let the rest of your species burn to save yourself.
I have to be honest, that all sounds really fantastic to me, Capo meowed. But if you could just do it for me, that would be brilliant. Ekali rocked back a little on her stems, realization rocketing through her, thorn to petal, and back.
You would destroy us,
she whispered.
There is another rising species on Earth. You never invented radio. We didn't know.
Why bother? The monkeys will make one, and then I can sleep on top of it. The static makes my belly tingle.
Compared to you, said the Clavar soprano, humans are joyful rosebushes bouncing through the stars. If you ever stopped napping long enough to escape Earth, you would sweep across this galaxy like nothing before, an endless wave of carnage. You would hunt our worlds one by one and ruin everything we've built. Only your laziness protects us.
Capo hopped down off the railing. She lifted her tail in the air haughtily and glanced back over her furry shoulder.
Most likely,
she purred. Best keep mum, don't you think? Wouldn't want to wake us up. 30. Silence and so many people. On the subject of interspecies sex, the only reliable rule is Gogunar Gorkanon's longest, most controversial, and least profanity-riddled unkillable fact. The 14th Special. A wide variety of interestingly shaped parents have petitioned to have it redacted on the grounds that, while true, it makes for screamingly awkward post-lullaby conversations, and its inclusion makes it very difficult to leave offspring home alone with any unguarded household appliances. All such requests are routinely burned unread by the Gorkanon estate. The 14th unkillable fact states the following. Everybody fucks. Well, almost everybody. No force on this plane of reality can equal the drive to get a leg over, because it's the non-dimensional other space where all those nice, sophisticated fundamental forces meet and form a weird, wet, messy trash ball. Tension, friction, gravity, electromagnetism, thrust, torque, resistance, elasticity, drag, momentum, inertia, pressure, chemical reactivity, fusion, conservation of energy, self-loathing, humiliation, and loneliness. Being ashamed of it makes about as much sense as being ashamed of the speed of light. Everybody is bizarre and disgusting and interesting and fixated on fetishes they wouldn't admit to their grandmother on pain of vaporization and worthy of love. You
are bizarre and disgusting and interesting and fixated on fetishes you wouldn't admit to your grandmother on pain of vaporization and worthy of love. It's a literal goddamned zoo out there, so this is the best I can do for you. Don't giggle when the other entity takes their clothes off. Secure enthusiastic consent. Don't mix silicon and carbon without extensive decontamination protocols. Tidy up your house if you expect to bring someone home. Don't expect anything you wouldn't offer. Remember that every person is an end in themselves and not a means to an end. Don't worry too much about what goes where and how many of them there are. Don't mistake fun for love. Try your best. Be kind. Always make them breakfast. And use protection. Chromosomes are not nearly such picky eaters as you might think. Just because the other fella is a plank of sentient wood from planet 2x4 doesn't mean you can't get pregnant, and the splinters won't be nearly as fun coming out as they were going in. The fact is, neither anatomy, nor culture, nor inconvenience, nor the linearity of time, nor distance, nor food allergies, nor federal law, nor a dimensional rift, nor strict parents, nor the threat of instant and hilariously excruciating death upon contact with one solitary smear of foreign bodily fluids can stop people after a bit of strange. And the stranger the bits, the better. Because genes are a bunch of thrill-seeking little shits, always looking for the next new thing. The very first time the very first species discovered that they were not alone in the universe, they started eyeing up the other hostile carbolic acid-blooded space squid, winking compulsively and asking them if they wanted to intermix and gill. Where there's a wang, there's a way. I once saw an Ursula hook up with a mime, a tuberous begonia, and a bottle of expired milk. There's no unseeing that. In the end, there is no atom in this galaxy but that someone hasn't tried to fuck it. Except me. Who needs a drink? Generally, this holds up to experimentation. Otherwise, it would be a semi-killable fact, included only in the older editions. Sex may not look the same in terms of number, kind, duration, pronouns, content, or survivability from species to species. It may not be advisable under even the most hastily drawn up occupational health and safety guidelines, but it's pretty much always happening everywhere. The variety of genders across disparate species makes the human fixation on rigidly defined sexual orientations seem as adorably, bafflingly old-fashioned as a butter churn in a travel agency. The definitions of sex across worlds vary so much that the Elec word for to make love, which can be loosely translated as emblachinate, also means to swim, to dance, to fish, to grow up big and strong, to hide a body for a friend, to be surprised that they're still making the candy one loved as a child, to really and truly self-actualize, to maintain an antiquated belief in fairies, to jump, to sing, to dig, to secure financing, to stalemate, to lay tile, and to vigorously debate the social issues of the day. On some planets, sex isn't even remotely connected to reproduction. The Smaragdi, for example, have 6.5 genders. Nasuno Uf used the pronouns she and her only because it seemed, in the cultural documents from Earth, that people utilizing those pronouns got to wear flashier clothes and considerably more tribal paints. The Smaragdi create children via battle royale combat, in which the spilled blood of the losing parents contributes only the most basic recessive baseline genes to the resulting offspring. They are renowned and sought after lovers due to their stamina, open-mindedness, and levitational abilities. Although not having to worry about getting one knocked up is probably a contributing factor. For other species, a light cough will land you in midnight feedings and a sensible family car before you can say, "Sorry, I've got a bit of a cold." In the presence of a pollinating clavar, it's best to cover your mouth.
There are, naturally, a few asexual species, and they do seem to get a lot more done in a day. But even they give it a try once in a while, just to see what all the fuss is about, before shrugging and going back to grounding their self-esteem in concrete accomplishments, and finding fulfillment in skills and hobbies, like the twisted kinksters they are. Sex is universal. It's just not evenly distributed. In the face of a blistering universe of infinite possibility, mind-smearing variety, hopping nightlife, and a galactic pornography industry as venerable and august as any bank, the innate sexual conservatism of any given species usually lasts about 3.4 seconds. Which is how Decibel Jones came to find himself in the executive suite of the South Wharf Hilton on Letost, propped up by the pillows endemic to hotels everywhere, even 7,000 light-years from the nearest hospitality degree program, differing only in the precise manner of their inadequacy, snuggled between the smaragdin Nasuno Oof and a beam of exhausted moonlight. Decibel knew the basics of Gogonar Gorkanon's 14th special, though he couldn't have put a name to it, or expressed it as concisely as a lonely heart yurtmak in the midst of a chemically volatile forest. He knew it by instinct, and the hard-earned, precariously rigged experience of an adulthood spent being reasonably attractive, a couple of years spent massively famous, and a life spent fascinated by everyone he ever met, if occasionally only for a few minutes at the outside. Jones couldn't entirely be certain that what had transpired over the previous couple of hours fell under the dictionary definition of sex. It was more like a very complete entry in Rogers. The moonlight, who was called Gobo, had been straightforward enough. The Asdrian post-punk filament harmonic frontman had slipped into the elevator with Decibel and Nasuno as the party was shutting down, when he'd asked, rather cheekily, given that tonight might well be Decibel's last chance for a good time, whether the two of them would be interested in collectivizing. Des thought he could imagine how sex with a swaggeringly masculine moonbeam might go, and it did, more or less. Gobo shone all over everywhere and promptly passed out without returning the favor. Nasuno was more complicated. She'd disappeared into the bathroom the moment Gobo was snoring, which, in a shaft of moonlight, manifested as a slow, steady flicker that, before long, faded away to nothing at all. The Asdia, being mostly photons, have a distinct advantage when it comes to escaping potentially awkward situations, and are famous for simply going off like an embarrassed light switch. The room was actually Nasuno's personal suite, though the replicated human hotel room, down to the minibar and flat-screen television accompanied by a remote control with enough buttons to manage the settings on the known universe, could hardly have been less designed for her comfort. A small landfill of suitcases, musical accoutrements, and equipment covered the floor, none of which Decibel could have figured out how to use if you held a mic to his head. It really was a stonking huge remote. It didn't really fit in with a sleek late-model TV. That thing was the love child of a 1980s home entertainment system and a space shuttle command console. The buttons glowed softly violet. With trembling fingers, her eyes wide with desire, Nasuno Oof emerged from the ensuite holding the instrument of her love between them. It was a hairbrush. "And what do you expect to do with that?" Decibel asked nervously.
"The usual?"
Nasuno said. Her pale eyes glistened with lust and confusion. "You know, sex. Copulation. The old in-out. That's what we're both after, isn't it?" Decibel Jones shrugged.
"Oh, sure, love. I can take a little paddling if that's what you're into."
"No. Not paddling, for crying out. What good would that do? This is how we do it on Pulul. Look, I know you showed that Eska a good time,
I didn't think you'd be such a prude.
Don't be upset, Nessie, my darling. I'm here to learn. Why don't you walk me through it? Just give me a little preview. What do you like?
How do the Smaragdi get down?